This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote. The head of Haiti's National Police Force said four people suspected of carrying out Wednesday's assassination of President Jovenel Moïse were killed in a shootout with police. Chief Leon Charles told reporters in Port-au-Prince that two other suspects, whom he described as mercenaries, were arrested during the shootout. Three officers, police officers, who were held hostage by the suspected assassins, were freed. Charles did not provide any further information on the operation. A manhunt was launched shortly after Moïse was gunned down during a pre-dawn raid on his private residence in a wealthy suburb of Port-au-Prince. His wife suffered critical injuries and is being treated at a Miami, Florida hospital. For details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. By remote, this is VOA News. Former South African President Jacob Zuma has begun serving a 15-month prison term. Zuma decided to hand himself in over to authorities Thursday to obey the order from the country's highest court, the Constitutional Court, that he should serve a prison term for contempt of court. A tweet posted by the Zuma Foundation said he decided to comply with the incarceration order soon after the South African police confirmed that Zuma was in their custody. 2 weeks after the collapse of a Florida condominium, officials announced Wednesday that they were shifting from rescue to recovery as there was no chance of life. The Miami-Dade assistant fire chief told families of the people who had remained unaccounted for that rescue dogs and listening devices would be removed and that workers would continue to search for human remains. No survivors have been found since the earliest hours after half of the building collapsed back on June 24th. The Miami-Dade mayor said 8 more bodies had been recovered on Wednesday, raising the death toll to 54. 86 people are still unaccounted for. A container ship anchored in Dubai caught fire late Wednesday, authorities said, causing an explosion felt across the commercial hub of the United Arab Emirates. There were no immediate reports of casualties at the port. Early Thursday, the Dubai government issued a statement saying that emergency services had brought the blaze under control. The extent of damage caused to the sprawling port and surrounding cargo was not immediately clear. The port is not only a critical global cargo hub, but a lifeline for Dubai and surrounding Emirates, serving as the point of entry for essential imports. Authorities in Afghanistan said Wednesday pro-government forces had pushed back Taliban insurgents from parts of the northwestern city and regained control of official buildings after hours of fierce clashes. Taliban fighters have made rapid territorial advances across Afghanistan since May 1st, when the United States and NATO allies formally began withdrawing their last remaining troops from the country. U.S.-led foreign forces are supposed to fully withdraw from Afghanistan by September 11th deadline set by President Joe Biden. The foreign troop exit is the outcome of a peace deal negotiated by Washington with the Taliban in February of 2020 under then-President Donald Trump. For more news, join us, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
From the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Thursday, July 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambia's founding president, Dr. Kenneth Kaunda, has been laid to rest.
We have buried our first Republican president, the founding father of Zambia, and he's been buried at the presidential site where we have buried all our past presidents that have passed.
Zimbabwe reversed to 2020 lockdown as COVID-19 cases rise. Uganda says it has lost 37 health workers to COVID-19. And Malawi's parliament amends the country's labor relations laws.
We're not taking away the right to strike because that's a fundamental right that is enshrined in the Constitution. We're saying if you want to go on strike, you can go on and go on strike for whatever, however long you want. The employer just won't be liable to pay you because we do realize that labor is a fundamental factor for productivity.
And a new study linked small dams to higher rates of malaria. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zambia on Wednesday laid to rest its founding president, Dr. Kenneth Kaunda, who passed away June 17 this year. The burial came on the last day of the 21 day of national mourning, during which the late president's body was flown to the capitals of all 10 provinces. President Edgar Lungu has declared April 28 each year Mr. Kaunda's birthday as a public holiday. There was drama earlier Wednesday when one of the late president's sons, Kawechi Kaunda, petitioned the court to stop the government from burying his father at the official burial place for heads of state. A judge, however, ruled that while he was sympathetic with the family, the late President Kaunda was more than a family person. He was a statesman. Antonio Mwanza is media director for the ruling Patriotic Front Party of Zambia.
We have buried our first Republican president, the founding father of Zambia, and he's been buried at the presidential site where we have buried all our past presidents that have passed. At that site, you'll find the second Republican president, Dr. Frederick Jacob Titus Chiluba, the other former president who has been buried there, and this is the president who died in office, is President Levi Bawasa. He died in 2008 and was buried at the same presidential site. The other president who was buried there is the late President Michael Sata, who also died in office in 2015 and he was buried there. And President Kaunda has also been buried there today. He's become the latest former president to be buried at this presidential site.
I'm reading the Zambian newspapers, and some family members of the late president are saying that it was not his will to be buried where he is buried, and so they are going to organize another burial place for the former president.
Yes, a judicial review was filed in the High Court of the Republic of Zambia by one of the sons of the late president by the name of Kawechi Kaunda. And according to the court papers, Mr. Kawechi Kaunda, the son of the late President Kaunda, had contended that President Kaunda wanted to be buried next to his former wife, Madam Betty Kaunda. And the High Court has ruled today, and this judgment was given by Judge Muma, who has ruled that while he sympathizes with the fact that the Kaunda family or some members of the Kaunda family might have wanted President Kaunda to be buried at a private farm next to his former wife, the court still contended that President Kaunda was no ordinary citizen. He was the founding father of the nation, and he was the former president, and as such, he was a state property, and that's the reason why he was accorded a state funeral, and that personal preferences of some family members could not override public interest. It is in the collective Zambian citizens to see the founding father being honored and buried at the same site where other presidents of the Republic of Zambia have been buried.
So now the funeral has taken place. Now Zambia has another very important issue on hand, which is the August 12th election.
Yes, today was the last day of the 21 days of national mourning that was set by His Excellency President Edgar Chagwa Lungu to mourn the death of our founding father, President Kenneth Kaunda. Tomorrow, all of us are resuming our normal campaign schedules, and we'll all be flat out campaigning. But what has happened is that even as we go flat out to campaign, we will remember the following things in honor of the founding father, that we need to conduct our campaigns in a violent-free manner, that we need to preach unity and peace,
that we need to fight tribalism and regionalism, because these are the principles that our late founding father stood for. So even as we stretch into the last 26 days of the national campaign, we will, on our part as Patriotic Front, the ruling party, and following His Excellency President Edgar Chagwa Lungu's preaching and directives, is that we should continue to honor the founding father, President Kenneth Kaunda, by having violent-free campaigns, issue-based campaigns, and campaigns that are based on patriotism as opposed to regionalism, tribalism, and the spread of hate speech.
Antonio, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much. The pleasure is mine.
Antonio Mwanza is the media director for the ruling Patriotic Front Party of Zambia. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. Malawi's parliament on Wednesday made several amendments to the country's Labor Relations Act, making it possible for an employer to deduct wages from employees who choose to go on strike. Deputy Labor Minister Vera Kantukule says the amendment is in line with the International Labor Organization's guidelines and international best practices, which allow an employer to respond to a strike by withholding wages from the employee on the basis of the principle of no work, no pay. The Malawi Congress of Trade Unions and its members went to Parliament early Wednesday, arguing that they were never consulted about the changes, but they were unable to persuade the lawmakers. Parliament also clarified the categories of essential services to which the right to strike and lockdown does not apply. Once again, Deputy Labor Minister Kantukule.
The bone of contention was where the bill is empowering the employer not to pay when workers are striking. So the unions were saying, no, then that means we're taking away the right to strike and whatever. So we're not taking away the right to strike, because that's a fundamental right that is enshrined in the Constitution. We're saying if you want to go on strike, you can go on and go on strike for whatever, however long you want. The employer just won't be liable to pay you, because we do realize that labor is a fundamental factor for productivity. So if people go on strike for as long as they want to go on strike, then there will be no productivity as well. So as a Minister of Labor or as government, we need to ensure that we are balancing the two. While we are protecting the labor force, at the same time, we also have to protect the interests of the employers, the investors at the same time.
So, madam, how does that protect the workers if you are saying that the employers cannot pay them when they are on strike? At the same time, you're saying the strike is protected under the Constitution. How does that work?
No. What the law is providing is to say you can go on strike, because by the time that the workers are going on strike, then it means dialogue has failed. The law is providing for procedures to be taken before the strike has to happen. So we give social dialogue a chance before people go on strike. So by the time people go on strike, it means social dialogue or other avenues have failed. So what we are saying is that we need to give social dialogue a chance. That's number one. The second thing we are saying is international labor organizations, they are the ones that came up with the Convention on Freedom of Association, for example. But they also gave an opportunity for unions to collect money from their members. And members do provide money to their unions. What does that money do? Because international general practice states that when the workers are going on strike, the unions pay for that period when the workers are on strike. So in Malawi, where does that money go? So we're saying you can go on strike for however long you want, but the employer will only pay for those first 3 days. After that, the union must take over to pay. After all, you have already paid them by your membership fee. That's what we're saying. So we're not taking away the right to strike. The right to strike is very much intact, because as far as we are concerned, that's a fundamental human right.
The union workers were saying that they were never consulted, and they argue, how can you discuss such an important bill without consulting the people it might affect?
No, that's not true. The consultations on the bill started way back in 2016. We even have minutes to prove that they were consulted. So it is not true that the unions were not consulted. They were consulted, but they may never have agreed to the amendments, but they were consulted. Let me explain something as well.
Please.
The law already provides that personnel in the essential services should not strike, all right? However, the law did not provide a list of what essential services are. So since 1996, since when the regulation came into effect in 1996, in Malawi, there hasn't been any essential services. That's why water boards could go on strike. Nurses or health workers could go on strike, because the essential services list was not gazetted. What this amendment does now is to empower the Minister of Labor to come up with that list and gazette it. as part of the regulation. So that the strike, so, and then also as an addition to that, the law is giving power to the Minister of Labour. So, for example, when there's a notice towards every institution before they go on strike, the Minister of Labour is notified. So what will happen is that if a strike, a notification of strike has been issued to the Minister of Labour, and if it's part of the essential services, the Minister of Labour is mandated by law to intervene before that date happens, to expedite the dispute. So that's where the balance is now.
It was very nice talking with you, and thank you for returning my call.
Thank you so much.
Vera Kantukwule is Malawi's Deputy Minister of Labor. She was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Ugandan health authorities say they have, since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, lost 37 health workers to the disease, including at least 16 doctors in June alone. Alima Athumani spoke to health workers on the challenges they are facing with a third wave of infections in this report from Kampala.
The Uganda Medical Association believes more than 100 health workers have died in the country because of the coronavirus pandemic since March of last year. Dr. Mkuzi Muhereza, the association's secretary general, says that number rose sharply last month.
The biggest beat was the last 2 weeks when we lost 16. Some people are on in intensive care and we are holding our fingers. And 14 were active clinicians and most likely got it from the hospitals.
The death of 16 doctors coincides with a general rise in COVID-19 cases last month before the country instituted lockdown restrictions. On July 5th, Uganda registered 425 new cases, bringing the cumulative number to 84,979. More than 2,000 Ugandans have died of COVID-19. According to investigations by the Ministry of Health, a total of 37 doctors have died of COVID during the pandemic. It says they all had underlying health conditions like diabetes and hypertension, or had not been vaccinated, or were of advanced age. However, Ministry of Health spokesman Emmanuel Aineviona acknowledged that doctors and other healthcare workers in hospitals face elevated risks due to lack of protective gear and medical gloves. He also says the government has been slow to give workers in COVID-19 units their extra pay for enduring risky conditions.
Yes, they might always be delays, but these delays are sometimes not within our controls because they are based on availability of resources. But we are doing our best as government. That's why even the Director General gave a guidance on double masking, and also we commit to ensuring that health workers always have what to use in the COVID treatment units and our health facility.
Last week, the head of the ministry's medical supplies agency, Dr. Moses Kamabare, said the increased number of infections has temporarily overwhelmed the ministry's ability to deliver personal protective equipment to all hospitals that need it. Kamabare said expanded deliveries will begin next week. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 8th. Rights groups in Zimbabwe are expressing concern about vulnerable groups after authorities imposed a new strict lockdown to curb a spike in coronavirus infections. The restrictions come as Zimbabwe's number of confirmed infections has more than doubled in the past week. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Monica Mchangwa, Zimbabwe's information minister, told reporters late Tuesday that a recent spike in COVID-19 cases has forced authorities to impose tighter restrictions. Officials had already imposed a nighttime curfew last week.
Exemption mechanisms, which was used during the first lockdown in 2020, will be reactivated with immediate effect. This will certainly reinforce the current efforts of containing the spread of COVID-19. Stiffer penalties will be imposed for violations of COVID-19 restrictions, including the withdrawal of operating licenses. As you might be aware, the entire country is now under level 4 lockdown.
Samuel Wadzai is the head of Zimbabwe Vendors Initiative for Social and Economic Transformation. He says his group opposes the reintroduction of exemption letters that only allow essential workers, such as police and government employees, to reach their jobs.
We just hope that it's going to be instituted in a transparent manner In the past, we've seen these exemption letters being used to block the operations of informal traders. So it is our hope that there will be clear communication in terms of where people in the informal economy will get the letters, and there will be enough measures to ensure that one gets these letters in a manner that does not promote corruption.
Mchangwa said the government is also intensifying its vaccination program as part of an effort to contain the global pandemic. About 810,000 Zimbabweans out of a population of 14 million have received their first shot, and about 575,000 have received their second inoculation since the program started in February. Dewa Mavinga is the head of Human Rights Watch in Southern Africa. He says the government should concentrate on vaccinating the adult population and essential workers instead of tightening lockdown regulations.
This is to get the wrong end of the stick, because this will not in a big way address the real challenges. And the government is focused on a heavy-handed response that is not suitable for the Zimbabwean context, particularly when you look at the vast majority of Zimbabweans who live in poverty, who depend on the informal economy for their livelihoods, and who have no way to get the so-called exemption letters with which to travel, go about their lives. And we also know that the government of Zimbabwe is not supporting these people in terms of intervention packages.
Last year, the government said it was giving about $10 to each family a month affected by lockdown regulations. On Wednesday, most vendors did not take heed of the government's call to stay at home unless they have exemption letters. One of them is Lucia Mutetwa, who sells second-hand clothes. She says, I only see corruption increasing because of these letters, because everyone wants to go somewhere with an exemption letter or not. This only gives police an advantage. They will start demanding bribes as they were doing during the last time during the lockdown, says Mutetwa. Zimbabwe has 56,014 confirmed coronavirus infections and 1,939 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University, which tracks the global outbreak. The numbers have more than doubled in the last few weeks. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
A new study links small dams to higher rates of malaria in nearby areas, according to research in four river basins in sub-Saharan Africa. Jonathan Lutz, a co-author of the study, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the new information and how it can be used to improve malaria prevention on the continent.
There's much more malaria associated with small dams than large dams. Basically, a lot of the previous work we and others have done has been mainly focused on large dams because it's easier to find their location. The bigger thing is, in terms of the aggregate malaria impacts of dams in Africa, we often used to say these are the impacts of dams in Africa, but implicitly we meant large dams in Africa because that's what we looked at. What this research tells us is that those were actually quite a low approximation of the impacts of dams in Africa when you're just looking at large dams. If you package them all together, large and small, you know, dams of any size, it would be on the order of three or more times greater than the numbers we had produced previously.
When you say the impact, can you go into a few more details about what you mean by that?
So we just actually looked at one of the main types of malaria, and Plasmodium falciparum. From that same strain of malaria, there's much more around the reservoirs than further away. And basically, we delineated the impacts at 5 kilometers kilometers from the reservoir shore. So then we said that's area that's affected.
Now that you guys have pinpointed this, would there be very specific interventions that could be done, because it is known now that small dams actually result in higher malaria transmission? Is there, I don't want to say an easy fix, but does this research kind of enable more of a pinpoint process?
I just want to highlight one other kind of interesting nuance that came out of this paper we did, is that we looked at, I think, three, if I'm going to try to remember right, 2000, 2005, to 2010 and 2015. So basically 4 years. So we tried to understand also the trends, because there was data available in that kind of every 5 year time frame that I just mentioned. So we wanted to understand the trends in malaria transmission around dams and then compare those with trends in malaria transmission generally. So one of the things you find in Africa at a general level is malaria is trending downward. And I think thanks to a lot of the efforts from like Roll Back Malaria in other probably national level programs. But what we found was around reservoirs, that wasn't the case. It held up. So, you know, it's particularly concerning, or there's and something we'd flag is that these will continue to be hotspots, or in some ways like anomalies or outliers, whatever word you want, of continued malaria transmission, just because oftentimes they give rise, the water reservoirs create puddles and they just give rise to so many mosquitoes that some of the conventional measures don't have the same level of impact as they would elsewhere.
That was Jonathan Lutz, co-author of the study about the impact of large and small dams on malaria transmission in four river basins in Africa. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from South Africa. The United Nations has called Africa's Sahel region the canary of the coal mine for the effects of climate change. Persistent drought and desertification has contributed to conflict and migration in the region. Burkina Faso rapper turned farmer Art Melody channels the struggles of being on the front line of climate change into his music. Henry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou.
Art Melody is a well-known musician in Burkina Faso, rapping in the local Djula and Moré languages. His songs convey the fear and emotion felt by millions of people across Africa's Sahel region because of the impact of global warming. The Sahel is seeing the worst effects of climate warming anywhere on the planet, says the UN. Farmers bear the brunt of the changes because 80% of the Sahel's economy is agrarian. Art Melody knows from experience the negative impact on farm production because he's a farmer himself.
Et puis bon, il fait de plus en plus chaud.
It's getting hotter and hotter, so there's less rain, he says. Climate change is a reality. He says our grandparents said it used to be that the rainy season would start in April, and now it can start in July. So there's a real difference between 1970 and now. The UN says the impact of desertification and drought on farmers is one of several factors causing the Sahel conflict in Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger. Combatants include terror groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. More than 2 million people have been displaced because of the fighting, and more than 20,000 people have been killed since 2012, according to data compiled by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. Ibrahim Thiaw is Executive Secretary of the UN Convention to Combat Desertification.
So when there's a drought, it's a disaster. It's hell. When that situation happens, you have two phenomena, flight and fight. Either you flee because there is no way you can produce anymore, or you fight with your neighbors for the limited resources that are still there.
Conflicts often arise between ethnic groups that traditionally grow crops and those that herd livestock, since land usually cannot be used for both purposes. While that's a major obstacle, technology can help, says a representative of a Burkinabe Farmers' Union. Until the effects of climate change in the Sahel are mitigated, farming will likely get harder, and the Sahel's conflict will likely get worse. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
And that's it for this Thursday, July 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.